4Q.
Lewin, what you found out so far is this winter field day, which not many of us know a lot about it, to your knowledge, from what you found so far, is it an ARRL sanctioned event, or is it one of these events that's sanctioned by CQ magazine? I know that CQ magazine used to have a couple of contests that they sanctioned. I don't remember looking, I mean, when you and I read QST magazine every month, I have to be a life member, you'll see lots of information about the ordinary field day in June. The winter field day, I wonder, I don't think it gets as much press, and so if it's an ARRL sanctioned event, it's not very well advertised from my point of view, but maybe it's because I'm not smart enough to look in the right place. N2RQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
From what I've seen so far, I don't see any mention of specific affiliation there. The organization is winterfieldday.com, and they have an email address of wfda@winterfieldday.com. So I've been jumping around on their website, and they are supported by N3FJP logging software, as well as, I think, W3KM and stuff like that, although none of that is necessary, according to their website. It is interesting. Usually, at that particular time of year, it's very busy for me, so I'm not too likely to get into it. But there are so many things. I mean, if you're interested in the contesting, if you're interested in doing any of the stuff, you cannot find a weekend when there are not multiple contests going on in all different categories. One of the things that we did is something called Islands on the Air. Well, there are two. There's Islands on the Air, which is international. Wait. And there's another one which is domestic, called the U.S. Islands on the Air. And what we did, and if you could look that up, what I did with a team of people from Brooklyn Tech, we went with a portable station and set up and activated Governor's Island. We were the first station to qualify on Governor's Island. So there are lots of different opportunities, and so it's really a question of what do you want to do, and you certainly can have lots of fun. Back to you, Dick, and to our queue.
Yeah, there are events where you put a national park on the air. There are events where you put a particular lighthouse on the air. So for a weekend or for a particular 24-hour event. So there's quite a few, as you were saying, Lou, essentially every single weekend, maybe almost every single day. Somewhere, if you dig deep enough, there is a ham radio event for a particular group, so to speak. Good stuff. And is it a contest? Is it a demonstration of emergency operation? The field day that we all know about is all of the above. And each person who goes has various motivations as to why he's doing it. To get away from the family, to have a great big set of eyeball QSOs with his buddies, to stay out all night, so to speak, in some cases. I make it a 24-hour event when I visit a few of the local groups doing field day, and I get into conversations. Sometimes we solve some really good problems at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you know what I mean, with those conversations. A little bit of a joke there. Okay, so, Joe, as you dig into that a little bit deeper, it was KC2QIW from Harrison, New York, I think it is, who asked the original question. Yeah, Harrison, New York. And nice picture of him in his shack if you go to QRZ.com. So, Joe, as you dig into this a little bit more and you find out which ones are of great interest to you, please come back and tell us what you find. Next person on our list with a question was Wes into XJN. What question would you like to ask the group tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet.
The subject to discuss are the question, parametric oscillator. If you could say a few words about it, especially in regards to body cap and face light loops or synthesizers or oscillators, amplifiers, frequency multipliers, and direction.
Yeah, Wes, I think I heard you having an earlier conversation tonight with John, and you had either phase lock loops or waveguide that you thought you might have a question, but then John was telling you that in order to please this group, it's got to be in the form of a question. With rare exception, we don't ask for people to give a presentation, so to speak, that wasn't in the form of a question that people would have. You can make as many presentations you want.
No, I don't want to make presentation. Okay.
You can make as many.
You could say, what is parametric oscillator and what is the application?
You can make as many presentations you want on your TechNet, on your particular gathering of people. But on this particular one, it's got to be in the form of a question. And you said some words. I didn't hear a question. I'm going to turn it back to you. I've heard some words. I've heard you mention subjects. I didn't hear a question. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Yeah, I was under the impression that you were asking for comments or questions or opinions. And there are no specific questions or comments or opinions, but thank you for enlightening me in this area. So if everything has to be, from now, in form of question, what is harmonic oscillator or parametric oscillator, what is the application for it, and how that affect us. Patrick here.
Okay, when I'm asking for a question or a comment, it's usually a comment on the subject of the question that's on the floor at that time. Or maybe it's a comment correcting a previous question of a previous week. So I'll give you a few words on harmonic oscillators. And the greatest application I know of is the way almost everybody gets onto the 10 gigahertz ham band. They do it by way of a transverter. That means it's a chunk of electronics that swishes your, that changes your frequency when you're transmitting and changes the frequency when you're receiving. Most transverters on most of the UHF and above bands, above 1 gigahertz, most of the UHF transverters, UHF, SHF, and EHF, they use the most popular tunable IF is 144 megacycles. So you start off with a 144 megahertz all-mode transceiver running in the milliwatt level usually. It goes into a mixer. You mix with 10.224 gigahertz, 144 megacycles, mixed with 10.224, and out of that mixer comes 10.368, the agreed-upon maximum used frequency for the calling frequency on the 10 gig ham band. You're about to ask, where the hell did 10.368 come from? Let me drop. 10.368 became a gentleman's agreement starting in the late 60s. It is the 72nd harmonic of 144. Most guys with their crystal-controlled transmitters in the 1968-1970 time frame could generate a signal, sometimes starting off with an 8-meg crystal, but they could generate a signal at 144 megs. Every transmitter has some harmonics. Therefore, listening to harmonic number 72 of 144 meg happens to be 10.368. So therefore, everybody in those days had another transmitter that they could put on the air at 144. And if you've got a sensitive receiver on 10.368 gigahertz, and you listen to the 72nd harmonic of your 144 meg transmitter, you've got your own built-in marker. You know that your 10 gig receiver is working. Now, that 10.224 oscillator that goes into the mixer, that does the transverting, it takes your 144 meg IF signal, moves it up to 10.368 when you're transmitting, and when you're receiving, it takes the, let me drop. It takes the 10.368 signal. Again, you use that exact same mixer backwards, and now it mixes that 10.368 with the 10.224, and out comes 144. So your receiver that you're really using is operating at 144, but it's going into this transverter. So now, an oscillator at 10.224, very accurately controlled, crystal-controlled oscillator, in theory with no drift at 10.224. Where in the world does that start off from? And that's a so-called brick oscillator assembly, because it literally looks like a chunk of aluminum that's about 5 inches cube. You apply 19 volts to it at about a quarter of an ampere, and it has a built-in fifth overtone crystal operating at roughly 110 megahertz. So there's a crystal in there running in the fifth overtone at roughly 110 megs in this brick oscillator assembly. That goes into a high-power amplifier that's running at roughly 1.5 gigahertz with a cavity oscillator using the 110 meg crystal oscillator, fifth overtone crystal, as a phase-lock loop. The cavity oscillator running at the half-watt level, so to speak, at 1.5 gigahertz, then goes into a varactor multiplier assembly, which chooses the eighth harmonic or whatever it is, that turns out a 10.224. So you can see the so-called brick oscillator assembly. It's got all kinds of fancy multiplying going on. It's a fifth overtone crystal at 110 megs, 105 megs, in that order, used as a reference oscillator for the phase lock loop running at half a watt and a cavity oscillator at 1.5 gigs. That in turn is going into a varactor diode assembly with a filter that selects the eighth harmonic at 10.224 and rejects everything else. The bottom line of these very well designed assemblies that were in wide use in the microwave commercial market for lots and lots of decades, these things, the original brick oscillator assembly probably sold for $3,000 on the surplus market. Now ham radio operators can buy them for $100, and when you look at that with a well-tuned spectrum analyzer, the purity of that signal at 10.224, the amount of drift, it almost has no drift, as long as you're giving it a steady 19 volts that doesn't have any hum on it. It's a crystal-controlled signal that's all kinds of harmonic multiplying going on, but the motivation, as you can see, is to have a pure signal at 10.224 to do the transverting function. So that you've got this chunk of electronics that your tunable IF goes to, and out comes the microwave signal for both transmitting and receiving. So we drop. Compared to all the other ham bands, I mean, if I wanted to operate on the 40-meter ham band, I go out and buy a transmitter where the hold-on transmitter is designed to operate at 144 megs. By that kind of philosophy, you would think if I want to operate at 10.368, I would go out and buy a transmitter that operates at 10.368. Well, until very recently, that didn't exist. The magic of those microwave bands is that you have to homebrew that equipment. You have to assemble your own brick oscillator assembly, your own mixer, your own amplifiers, your own antennas. And so so it's a bit of an effort to get there. But to the guys who go there, they think it's definitely worth it. You're now talking to real hams who know how to homebrew equipment And when you start comparing notes with that guy, when you start picking each other's brain, you've got a common denominator that you both solved a problem of designing and building the equipment and testing it and getting on the air with it. And when you finally do all that, let me drop it. Good sound, good common sense would lead you to believe that the 10 gig signal, microwave signal, is only good for line of sight. You can talk to somebody 30 miles away if you're sitting on a mountaintop. Everybody believes that. Not at all. You build sensitive enough equipment much beyond the so-called gunplexer. A gunplexer is a very low sensitivity, very inexpensive, but very low sensitivity. You use real so-called narrow band techniques to get on 10 gigs. And you suddenly realize that that band has a band opening some portion of every 24-hour day in which you might be able to hear somebody hundreds of miles away, 3, 5, and 10 times beyond Earth curvature. You're talking to that guy by forward-propagated tropospheric scatter, by way of another kind of phenomena. I can't even think of the name of it right now. When you get a layer of moist air down low and dry air up high, you get a kind of refractive bending of the signal, and when the atmosphere is supporting that, as it does almost some portion of every 24-hour day, let me drop it. It's kind of like a frequency inversion, but it's not quite. I mean, a temperature inversion, that can give it to you. But there's another name I'm having trouble thinking of that the guys on 10 gigs use as to how they get onto that band, but you start hearing signals when you've got sensitive narrowband equipment that has a fraction of a microvolt sensitivity. You start hearing signals from hundreds of miles away, even though the guy is only running a watt of power into a 2-foot diameter dish that clears the local trees. And my best DX on that band, for instance, from my home to a 2-foot dish on my tower, talking to a guy in Rogan's Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. I think he was 380 miles away. And during the half hour that I talked to him on single sideband, he was running the 1 watt level, I was running 200 milliwatts, and the signals going back and forth sounded like he was in my backyard. It was a sideband signal, 20 dB out of the noise, if you know what I mean, dead full quieting. You would never believe that a microwave signal would behave that way. Well, until you construct the equipment and really go on the air and really test what Mother Nature can do, each frequency region has its own unique kind of propagation. So, as you can tell, oscillators that can be multiplied in frequency and yet be crystal controlled and very steady, they've got a lot of value when it comes to microwave ham radio. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
Steve X, be Wes2N.
And K2J with a question.
N2XJN. Well, I was mostly interested with parametric oscillator. There's a difference between harmonic oscillator and the parameter of the system at some frequency, typically different from the natural frequency of oscillation. There was...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What is...
Oh, wait, that's the Connecticut repeater here. The Pennsylvania repeater here.
Just wondering what that was.
So, the role of voltage control capacitors would be varactors in parametric oscillators, circuits, and direction.
Okay, I think I have no experience with what you're calling a parametric oscillator circuit. But frequency multiplying, I do have. I know Paul has a question, and Eric in that order. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
I was just wondering if you were thinking of ducting. Was that the phrase you were looking for?
Ducting comes very close. But there's something beyond ducting. And all of a sudden I've forgotten the word that they use on 10 gigahertz. ducting comes closed, forward propagated tropospheric scatter comes closed. Ah, I just thought of it, super refraction. They call it the super refraction phenomenon. Because water vapor has a higher dielectric constant, water itself has a dielectric constant of 81. So air that has a high humidity has a higher dielectric constant than dry air. Therefore, you get, because at late at night, you tend to get dew close to the ground, dew forming close to the ground, it may be forming on your grass and on your roof of your automobile, and you get drier air up top, you get this this bending effect that I'm just describing to you. They call it the super refraction phenomenon. So if this kind of weather phenomenon, let me drop it. If this weather phenomenon happens over, let me pick her a number, a 400-mile region, Mother Nature just created that kind of weather over a 400-mile region, the super refraction phenomenon, that's the word they use for it, can create a downward bending of the wave, and if the downward bending of the wave is equal to Earth's curvature or a little bit beyond, that guy 400 miles away sounds to you like he's in your backyard. It gives you a tremendously strong signal. And if you think about what's happening, ordinarily a signal going out obeys inverse square law. Inverse square law, because the signal is spreading in azimuth and it's spreading in elevation. The signal is, even though you're using a high gain antenna, in my case it's got a 3.5 degree beamwidth because it's a 2-foot diameter offset parabolic dish. So you think you're just getting this pencil beam. Well, that pencil beam has a certain, it's got 3.5 degrees of horizontal beamwidth and 3.5 degrees of vertical beamwidth. So it is spreading in azimuth and it's spreading in elevation. When the atmospheric super refraction phenomenon takes place, the elevation spreading goes away. That atmosphere is focusing that wave for you in elevation as if you had a much bigger diameter dish. You're still spreading in azimuth, but you're no longer spreading in elevation. Therefore, you don't get inverse square law propagation, you get inverse linear propagation. You don't fall off 6 dB per octave, you fall off 3 dB per octave. You put that all together with a 400-mile range, and all of a sudden a signal that should be super weak turns out to be super strong. And so on the 10 gig band, when you live within 200 miles of a major body of water, like the Atlantic Ocean, you get a band opening some portion of almost every single 24-hour day. Unless you built the equipment in...
Repeater, timeout.
Unless you built the equipment and really used it under working conditions, and even though in my case, it's a transistorized transmitter that never radiated more than 200 milliwatts, 0.2 watts. That's real QRP. But on 10 gigs, that's a medium amount of power to those guys. I talked to people in 10 states on 10 gigahertz using 0.2 watts of power. And hard to believe that the focusing you can get and what Mother Nature will do for you, you think it's only line of sight. Well, the word line of sight has got a lot of different meanings in this case when you got super refraction going on. And I think even broadcast stations like tonight, where we're starting to hear signals from very long distance, in some cases, that is a minor form of ducting, super refraction, and whatever. KE2EJ, K2RIW, be great, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, two things. One is, at your dish, did you mount the transmitter up there and fed the IF up the tower and supplied it with power? That's the way you operate it. And for Wesley, actually, if he looks up what a parametric amplifier is, he'll discover what a parametric oscillator is. And you can think of it as a pumped oscillator. It's in the world, it's a combination waveguide YAG type of oscillator. Basically, think of it as a resonant cavity that you pump. A parametric amplifier itself has lower noise than a traditional amplifier because a parametric amplifier, the reactance is varied rather than the resistance. So that's a whole nother long discussion. But anyway, how did you get your signals up there?
Thank you very much for this. Yeah, I was obviously interested with parametric oscillator, driven harmonic oscillator. Dick.
No, the parametric oscillator is a harmonically driven oscillator. The oscillator itself has its own natural frequency and you vary it.
In the case of the tunable IF operating at 144 megs, and because any normal transmission line operating at 10 gigs has a ridiculous amount of loss, you can get the loss a lot lower if you use waveguide. Not many guys are that enthusiastic to run waveguide up their 100-foot tower. Some do. But waveguide is not that deep, and to get 100 feet of it, well, you'd need about 120 feet of it to get into the house, if you know what I mean. And waveguide, as low in loss as it is compared to transmission coaxial cable, it still has 4.5 dB per 100 feet if it's brand new, silver-plated, dry nitrogen-filled, and everything is done just right. In real world, you end up with 5 or 6 dB of loss per 100 feet with the best waveguide you can buy at 10 gigs. Whereas if you think, what I did do, and what many guys do, is they send an ordinary 144 meg signal up the tower. The insertion loss of the cable doesn't count very much because you're sending 19 volts of power to run the brick oscillator assembly that's in a box behind the dish. Let me drop. So that transverter I've been talking about is located in a weatherproof box behind the dish at the 100-foot level of the tower. I send 144 meg signal up to it, and I send 19 volts up to it. It converts the 144 meg signal to 10.368, sends it into a transistorized amplifier that gives it up to 200 milliwatts. All that's in the weatherproof box, and it goes directly to the dish. So my 10 gig transmission line was only a few inches long from the back of the dish to the front of the dish, so to speak. And on reception, everything goes backwards through that exact same box, and 144 meg signal comes back down to me. Because there is gain at 144 megs in the receiving function, the insertion loss of the cable, 144 meg cable, almost doesn't matter. And the same thing on transmitting. Because the mixer only needed milliwatts of power, and I can easily generate watts of power at 144, the feed line could be a piece of RG58. So the nice thing about a remotely operated transverter right behind the dish is that all the very high loss hardware operating at 10 gigs only has to operate through inches of transmission line until it gets into the dish. So that's a popular way of doing it, Eric, and you can see you get the best to you get the best of both worlds with one catch. Let me drop.
Did you ovenize your crystal?
You and I are on the same wavelength, pun intended. That's exactly what I was going to talk about. The one catch is that now that dish and that transmitter behind it is out in the weather. And yes, at first I did not have an ovenized crystal. And the temperature characteristic of my crystal, running at the fifth overtone at 110 megs, roughly 105 megs, I had a graph that I had plotted by listening to the beacons that are on 10 gigs that are known to be pretty accurate. I had a graph where the temperature of the day told me what frequency I was on. but I was drifting by numbers like 20 kilohertz. 20 kilohertz when I went from 70 degrees Fahrenheit down to 30 degrees Fahrenheit. That would be 20 kilohertz different. Well, when you're telling a guy using a single sideband receiver or he's going to listen to you on Morse code, he would like to hear you to the nearest, he would like to know your frequency to the nearest 1 kilohertz, 20 kilohertz of temperature drift is a bit of a pain. On top of that, as you operated the transmitter and it generated some heat in the box, some additional frequency drifting of a few kilohertz would take place. So that's the catch. I should have had an ovenized crystal on that brick oscillator assembly. Let me drop it.
Have one more thing.
Some of the better-made brick oscillator assemblies have a built-in oven. Mine did not, Eric. KE2EJ on that question. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Control WK2J. Just out of curiosity, I know this is quite a number of years ago for you, so what did you actually use for a mixer? Did you get somebody's mixer ready together, or did you build one out of some diodes and a little bit of funny faces on your PC board?
There are a very small percentage of 10 gig ham radio operators that build their own mixer. But when it comes to a doubly balanced mixer assembly, either with SMA connectors or BNC connectors, there's a darn many of those on the surplus market. They sometimes only cost numbers like $10 or $15. They're so extremely high in performance, meaning that all undesired harmonics are suppressed by a good number of dB. The insertion loss is very low. The predictability is very high. It's a nice shielded small package. 90-some-odd percent of the guys on 10 gigs buy that doubly balanced mixer. And the word doubly balanced mixer means it's balanced on the local oscillator port, it's balanced on the RF port, it is not balanced on the IF port. It usually is a, what would you call it now, a diamond shape. There's four diodes put together in a kind of a ring that looks a little bit like a Wheatstone bridge, but each one of the legs of a Wheatstone bridge is a diode, a microwave diode. Let me drop this.
Mixer.
Somebody said mixer. There's a zillion brand names of that particular mixer that you can buy. Even mini circuits will sell you one. So buying the mixer assembly is the easiest way to build your own mixer. You're going through an awful lot of effort. You're not getting very much shielding. You're not getting higher performance. So why do it when you can buy that mixer assembly? So the brick oscillator, you buy that on the surplus market. Make sure it's got the right crystal in it and tune it up a little bit. The mixer you buy. So now there are a number of people who simply take that milliwatt signal coming out of the mixer and put that directly into a feed horn or directly into a dish, and they're on the air. And the slightly more advanced guys will buy something or build something that's got a milliwatt input and a hundreds of milliwatt output amplifier assembly. I ran 200 milliwatts of output with a two-stage amplifier after that mixer. KE2EJ, K2RIW. So you're one of those enthusiastic guys that would build all that as opposed to buying those sub-assemblies. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, it's a number of years back for you, so I was curious as to what way you want to quit. I built some 3-gig stuff and some 5-gig stuff, and I could have used a mini circuit mixer, but I decided to, since I had this little program that let me figure out the resonance of the phases that I made, I figured I'd give it a shot, so I made my own diode. They're basically ring diode mixers. But what did you do for a front end? Did you have a front end, or was it just from the feed horn into the antenna to receive?
It turns out that you would send up a command signal to that transverter assembly to either put it into the receive mode or the transmit mode. Transmit mode, I've already described it to you. In the receive mode, it took the exact same... I'm trying to think of the name. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of a very popular transistor. 2C something or other. A Fujitsu-made transistor. When used in the...
It was a gas FET?
Right, it was a gas FET. So, name a popular gas FET. All of a sudden, I can't think of the model number, Eric. Go ahead.
FJ203.
I have one more question.
I can think of about a half a dozen of them. HP was big on them, the Fujitsu was big on them, NEC was the most popular one I remember.
All of a sudden I thought of it, MGF-1402. Very popular, MGF-1302, MGF-1402. It gave you 10 milliwatts of output, that was the low-level amplifier stage, that went into a higher power transistor. That exact same transistor stage, in the receive mode, it got connected to the feed horn. It boosted up your signal by roughly 10 dB before applying it to the mixer. MGS-1402 was a couple of dollar field effect transistor, good to something like 20 gigahertz. At the 10 gig frequency range, it gave you some pretty nice performance. So you pre-amplify the signal before applying it to the mixer because the mixer had something like 8 dB of insertion loss. If you apply the signal directly from the dish to the mixer, the 8 dB of insertion loss would add 8 dB to your overall system noise figure, and that would knock down your sensitivity quite a bit. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Now, RYF, because I figured you had to have some kind of a front end to, you know, preamp to overcome the loss through the mixer. And, of course, you have to switch it in and out, unless you're smart about how you split it out. Actually, though, it's funny. Today, you can spend about 20 bucks, and at 10 gigs, you can get about 50 watts without too much trouble. It's a different world. The solid-state devices that go up the frequencies you've never heard of before. I mean, you get microwaves and RF, I mean, you get those magazines, you can see what's on the market these days. For the uplink in the city, they just bought an SSPA that's 250 watts, so off solid state, and it's a tiny little box with a lot of fans on it. K2IW, K2J.
So there are transistors out there that will give me 50 watts of output on 10 gigs. I'm guessing they're a little bit pricey. I'm guessing they're in the couple hundred dollar category. That's
not anymore. They used to be. Now they're in like the $30 and $40 range.
And what do they use for? Because it's a field effect transistor, and most field effect transistors can't tolerate more than 10 volts. So I'm guessing this thing is running
50 volts.
Wow, that's not an ordinary field effect. That's something else. Ordinary field effect usually cannot tolerate this kind of voltages, Eric. What?
No, they're MOSFETs.
Okay. It's you sure it's MOSFET and it's not silicon carbide? What's the name of the?
Yeah, silicon carbide, but not at those frequencies. There's a, you know, let me look it up and I'll tell you precisely.
I'll bet you it's silicon nitride. If you're running a...
That's it.
Silicon nitride. It's not an ordinary old-fashioned type field effect. Old-fashioned field effect, 10 volts is the maximum you can go. But silicon nitride, yes. These are very high performance, very low internal resistance, and they can tolerate 50 volts. And so if you try to develop 50 watts with 10-volt transistors, boy, you'd be doing an awful lot of summing of individual stages, power summing. Back to you, Eric.
Transistors themselves produce that kind of power. Don't forget, when you're... I don't know what they do with those frequencies. I know what they do with 400 and 1,000 megahertz. And basically, it's a hunk of metal with a whole bunch of dies on it, all connected to the, you know, all connected in parallel.
Understand. Okay, so I know we talked about oscillator multiplier assemblies. I'm not prepared to talk about parametric amplification or parametric oscillation at this time, Eric. I mean, Wes. And 2XJN, need any further fields on what we just discussed? K2IW, you got it, Wes.
I'm in. 2XJN. John, pick up. I have another question about interaction of electromagnetic field with matter. John.
Now, we're not going to take a second question tonight, Wes. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, on this particular subject, go ahead with your question. Your comment, John.
Just to let you know, K1MGN, JM, I want you to know that winter fest is absolutely on the ARRL list. So if everybody goes to the ARRL list, they'll probably be able to get, you know, dates, and maybe there's others. But he just wanted to get that across. And he was the weak station that was trying to get in.
Yeah, very fine, John. And the ARRL these days is listing everybody else's contests, even the ones that they don't necessarily sanction. So is that winter field day a ARRL sanctioned contest is an interesting question. They do have the winter QSO part. party in the end of January, which is ARRL sanctioned for many decades that I know of. And the really enthusiastic guys sometimes put up with some really wicked winter weather on top of mountains in New England to operate that contest. But that's the rare, really rugged bird, if you know what I mean. The next person on our list with a question was Rich, N2EO. Go right ahead with your question, Rich. K2IW, you're the last guy before we go over to the space report. I mean, before we go over to the mailbag.
Okay, Dick, we were talking about RF biohazards. So my question has pretty much been answered. The only thing I want to know, could I run into a problem with my village here? You and Barry put up the dipole on, you know, I use it mostly on 40, but I'm running 1,500 watts. I don't get on very often, but I have it. I wonder if you think I'll run into a problem and what I should do if I do.
By way of calculation or measurement, the answer is absolutely no. Your antenna is being supported by trees. Barry and I helped you put that up by ropes going to trees. If you loosened those ropes and lowered that dipole down to ground level, down to eye level, and you radiate 1,500 watts into that antenna, 6 feet off the ground, and if somebody walked up to that antenna and stood approximately 5 feet from it while you're running key down 1,500 watts, I'm pretty sure if I go through the calculation, you'll find out it's safe. You're spreading that energy over the length of your antenna is something like 97 feet, as I remember, and it's spreading that energy over that whole great big long distance. So at something like 5 foot of distance, calculated, you'd be safe. Because your antenna is roughly 30 feet in the air, until you run 50 kilowatts into that antenna, which it wouldn't take. Let me drop it. Until you run 50 kilowatts into that antenna, anybody walking around on your property, walking around in your house, is not going to be running into a biohazard. And we could support that, Rich, with calculations traceable to the Bureau, traceable to the American National Standard Institute C95 report. You think that something magic is going to happen that is suddenly going to create a radio frequency biohazard because of your particular environment. There's nothing in your environment that has a big enough radar cross-section of reflection at those HF frequencies to change it. So the laws of physics say that X number of watts going into a dipole that many feet long is spreading the energy in such a way that it becomes very safe. You don't have to measure the weight of each individual brick before you build your house with it. Well, you don't have to measure how much signal is coming out of your antenna. The laws of physics dictate that 1,500 watts into that antenna, more than 5 feet away, is very safe for human beings. N2EO, K2LAW, go ahead, Rich. And by the way, once they hear the word radio frequency biohazard and RF radiation, if they hear those words, they're going to be alarmed. You're going to discuss it as a transmission system, a signaling system, an RF signal, radio frequency RF signaling system, radio frequency communication system. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I'm aware of that. It's all in the wording. It's just that, you know, villages and towns and hamlets, they don't know anything about radio. And they're, you know, they get caught up in red tape. So far, I haven't had a problem. Anyway, that's it. Back to Ned and to Leo.
So the first section of the TechNet tonight ran for an hour and 45 minutes. Time for the mailbag. And go right ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
More like 2 hours. Very good. KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. All right. We have a young man here who's working on an old radio, and he needs some assistance. Let me let it drop, and I'll describe the problem.
You're right. I lost an hour. You got it, John.
Okay, he has an excellent old radio from the 30s, and it has a dynamic speaker. And he has a choke from a power supply, which will have the right amount of Henrys, and he'd like to know if he could substitute that for the permanent magnet, electromagnet that he has on the dynamic speaker, and put in a standard voice coil speaker. So he has five wires going to the speaker. He knows three go to the choke. The two that go to the voice coil, can he hook that up to a regular speaker? Should it work? If he has the DC straightened out, is there anything he should look out for? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
I think I can answer the question.
Sounds like you've already done that, Rich. In 2EO, go ahead. KQIW.
Yes, I used to restore some antique radios, and now that I'm getting well, and my mind thinks better, I'm going to get back to it. Yes, the old speakers were, there you have the voice coil and the electromagnet part that was doubled up as the choke in the power supply. The accepted method among most of the people that restore these radios, if the speaker was bad, you use the original audio system up to a regular permanent magnet speaker, and it used to double as a choke, you put a 5-watt 100 ohm resistor. That's what you do. Back to that.
Yeah, the 5-watt 100 ohm resistor gets you on the USB. See, your half wave or full wave rectifier on the 60 cycle input power usually was a Pi network, an input capacitor, a choke, and an output capacitor, and it gave you a nice, smooth power supply. In those days, you didn't have beautiful neodymium magnets to make a nice, high-efficiency loudspeaker. So in many of those days, you used an electromagnet to develop a strong enough magnetic field. So you had a coil of wire with a magnetic structure, iron, so to speak, and poured enough current through that coil, you develop a strong enough magnet on that so-called dynamic speaker. So now you had a double function going on. That coil was making the magnetic field that made the speaker work, and the coil was simultaneously acting as an IR choke for your Pi filter network for your main power supply. Let me drop. See, you sort of got two for one, but there's a catch. Your magnetic field in that Pi network is not steady. There's a little bit of a variation through that Pi network inductor, which is really part of the dynamic magnet of that speaker. Therefore, you had a speaker coil, and in many cases, you also had a humbucking coil. You knew exactly what the waveform was going to be of the current flowing through your electromagnet, and they put that exact same waveform, decreased in magnitude, out of 180 degrees out of phase, into the speaker coil as a humbucking magnet. Otherwise, the speaker would give you quite a bit of hum. So you could, if you want to, if the capacitors are big enough, the resistor is more than good enough to do the filtering. If you want to put in a couple of Henry choke to substitute for the electromagnet, that would be a Cadillac way of doing it. And by way of your oscilloscope, monitoring the 60 cycle ripple or the 120 cycle ripple on your power supply, let me drop it. You can make a decision that your electrolytic capacitors that are part of that filter network of that power supply, are they in good shape? Are they big enough? Do they need to be replaced? Do you have to put other capacitors across them because they partially dried out? The amount of hum you're getting out of that power supply, the amount of ripple, an oscilloscope or an AC coupled volt ohm millimeter will give you an indication of how much ripple. And it's not a showstopper. If you've got excessive ripple in the power supply because the capacitors are not big enough in microfarads, because there's not enough Henrys in the choke that you're putting in there, or the resistor you put in as a quick and dirty way of doing it, it's not a showstopper. You're going to have ripple in the power supply. Therefore, the radio is going to have some hum coming out of its loudspeaker. And it's not going to burn up because of that. You can then decide later on, I'm going to put in bigger capacitors. I'm going to put in a bigger choke. I'm going to use some kind of a humbucking network into my loudspeaker. There's various ways you can make that radio get restored and sound good. And it's a good, interesting test to measure the amount of ripple you're getting with the substitutions you're making. And quite often what happens, let me drop it. It's the old-fashioned dynamic speaker. Did the job very nicely in its day, but the cone dries out, turns into flakes, gets holes punched into it. The coil starts, it becomes misaligned, and the coil starts rubbing on the magnetic assembly. There's a zillion ways that your old-fashioned dynamic loudspeaker can fail, and to put in a modern loudspeaker that has a neodymium magnet in it, that's a lot more compact and probably higher in fidelity, that's a very nice change to make, if you know what I mean. And you could even use a so-called Tweed 16, a whole bunch of individual speakers acting as one great big combined woofer tweeter, and make a really good sounding system if you wanted to. And so there's a lot of experiments you can do with restoring that radio. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can make another comment, Jacob, I can, on the subject.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, a good place to get parts is a place called Antique Electronic Supply. And they're in Tempe, Arizona. You can Google them, their stuff is very good. They got replacement speakers. They've got stuff for refinishing the wood. Well, if you have a plastic, an early plastic cabinet, they got stuff for plastic repair. They got tools. They got everything. Antique Electronic Supply, Tempe, Arizona. They got tubes. They use, but they're guaranteed. Back to you, Dick.
Very good information, Rich. There are a group of guys out there that just really fall in love with these old, beautiful-looking, in their mind, radios, and like restoring them and bringing them up to a brand-new or even better condition. So, by way of Antique Electronics, you can now get the raw materials if you want to go that route. KC2WGB, K2RIW, got a job.
KC2WGB. Very good. Yeah, I'm sure he has the choke, so I would recommend that he puts the choke in there because otherwise he is going to have a hum problem. Resistor's not going to cut it for him. But it's a nice radio. It's the cabinetry is in perfect condition. It's amazing. And it's a 12-inch speaker. So he's got a nice JBL speaker he's going to throw in there, and he just wanted to know if that was going to be a safe way to do it, and it seems like he's got the approval. All right, let me let it drop. I got one more quick one.
By the way, John, the resistor would do the job beautifully if the capacitors were big enough in microfarads. With modern-day electronics, you can buy a zillion microfarads in a fairly small package. If your capacitor is big enough, the resistor is going to do the job equally as well as the choke. See, in those days, you couldn't get a whole lot of microfarads in a small package, and that's why they used a choke pi-type filter network and power supply in those days. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, I am aware of that. The only thing is, he's going to have to do more work on the radio, and he wants to leave it as much original as he can. So, and if it doesn't work, he could always increase them if he has to. But now he's got some more information to go on. Okay, now, got this young scientist. Oh, this is a beaut. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, on his test bench, he has constructed a little yardarm device, which from that yardarm he has two pith balls hanging from wires, and the pith balls are coated with a metallic spray or some kind of coating.
Okay.
His question is, if he brings some type of static electricity toward it, of course, they'll repel. But what he's trying to do is, he's hooking that yardarm up to an RF antenna, and he's running about 50 watts, and he wants to know whether he's running single sideband or FM. When he keys up, he knows the voltages are in phase and equal. Why don't the balls repel? There's no motion on those balls at all. Can I include Dick? Back to you, KC2 WGB.
The two coated pith balls hanging on some kind of a suspension device. You said the word wire. I think it should be string, a non-conductor. That is a kind of electroscope. Now, an electroscope, if you put an equal charge on those two pith balls, they will repel very strongly. If you put a few kilovolts on them, which, by the way, because the amount of picofarads of capacitance of those pith balls is such a small number, a few thousand volts on those pith balls represents a very small number of microjoules of stored energy, of stored charge. Very few microcoulombs, so to speak. And so putting a steady state voltage on them will create repulsion. Steady state voltage. You put RF energy on them, the RF energy is swinging between positive and negative on each half cycle, but the average is zero. So the pith balls think they're seeing something close to zero. You could, with a very large signal on the pith balls, get repulsion, because during the time the RF wave is positive, it would be positive on both pith balls if you hooked it up just right, and negative on both, and you would get some repulsion. But the amount of voltage you're putting on the pith balls to get the electroscope function is kilovolts. Your transmitter output into a 50 ohm line is running tens of volts, not kilovolts. Let me drop this. So in theory, from the transmitting, you could get a response, but you'd have to use some kind of an impedance matching device to bring the output of your tens of volts of transmitter up to kilovolts. But where you're suspending the pith balls on wires, it's a little bit of a problem, because the wires represent a short circuit to the yardarm, to the rest of the world that's grounded. I guess the yardarm could be an insulated structure. And now, in your electroscope in that particular case would be pith balls plus wires, both acting as a repulsive device when kilovolts are put there. If you and I own a Wimshurst machine, John, and our Wimshurst machine, when you turn that crank, easily generates more than 100 kilovolts. When you got that thing tuned up just right, you come very close to a quarter of a million volts comes out of that machine. It's got very little capacitance behind it, so it's not nowhere near as dangerous as you would think. Let me drop that. I don't think you and I know I own two or three different electroscopes. I don't know if you own one. I also own a so-called Volta's Hailstorm device. There's all kinds of electrostatic devices you can buy that'll give you a physical demonstration of the voltage coming out of a Wimshurst machine and the repulsion it creates. But the real voltage to give you that electroscope function, when you take some fur and rub it on a glass rod or in a polyurethane, a PVC rod, when you rub a insulating fur on a rod, and now you hold it near your pith balls, you've done a very simple operation, but it's hard to believe the static voltage you're building up is many kilovolts. So that electrostatic repulsion you get from an electroscope is demonstrating kilovolts. Your transmitter doesn't run that high. So That's part of the reason right now why I think he's seeing no response to the RF energy.